I'm Stuart Kelter, and this is Delving In. My guest today is Dr. David Olds, a professor at the Pediatrics Prevention Research Center at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. He has devoted his long and distinguished career to the developing and testing of very early interventions in family and child functioning, starting prenatally and continuing through toddler age. After devoting decades to high-quality, random assignment, longitudinal comparison studies showing that the approach yielded dramatic benefits, Dr. Olds went on to win grant after grant to implement what came to be called the Nurse Family Partnership Program, now in 40 states and 8 foreign countries, today serving 33,000 families in the U.S. and 18,000 families abroad. The program has shown positive, substantial long-term effects in the prevention of child abuse and neglect, school failure, injuries, depression and anxiety, and antisocial behavior in children. The program continues to monitor and adapt its practices to fit the specific cultural environments of the target families. Research from the Nurse Family Partnership Program has served as the primary evidentiary foundation for a $2.3 billion federal investment in evidence-based home visiting. It is an honor and a privilege, Dr. Olds, to welcome you to Delving In.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Stuart. You know something? Please call me David. Yeah, because I found myself wanting to say Dr. Kelter. So please, David.
Good. That sounds good. So before I start, I just want to say a word about my own interest in your work. I was a school psychologist as well as a clinical psychologist, but I was a school psychologist with the Las Cruces Public Schools for 26 years and was always frustrated at the difficulty in creating substantial change for children that were coming from very adverse environments and had all kinds of emotional problems. I mean, I was working specifically with emotionally disturbed children and was really wondering what would work better. And I knew that our school had Head Start and early Head Start starting at 2, and it didn't seem to be early enough. And so I did some research and I came upon your work. I think this is before the big expansion. And I was just so impressed by it, by its promise. So before we delve into the nuts and bolts of the program itself and the research behind it, I was wondering if you could first explore the rationale for the program, starting with how early in your career you recognized the unmet need for it. And along the way, let's also discuss the underlying theoretical model, attachment theory, and how it applies, and how you became acquainted with it.
Sure. Stuart, I finished up undergraduate school in 1970, in so many ways was a product of the kind of 1960s fervor to make a difference, and went to work in an inner city daycare center in Baltimore, working with poor preschoolers, and I thought that I was going to make the world of a different place. And I soon realized that for many of the children in my classroom, it was already too little and too late. One little boy couldn't sleep at nap time, and we couldn't figure out why he couldn't sleep. So one day, another teacher and I took him down to a playroom and talked to him and said, "Jamie, how come you can't sleep?" And he said, "If I sleep, I wet myself. And if I wet myself, my mom beats me." And so it was safer for him not to sleep at all. Another little boy in my classroom couldn't speak. He gestured. And he was being cared for by a really heroic grandmother. And his biological mother was an addict and an alcoholic and had almost certainly exposed him to substances in pregnancy and compromised his developing brain. You know, and so I thought, well, maybe the best thing to do is to have parent group meetings, to bring parents together, to talk about their children's needs. So we did that. And parents who were really engaged and wonderful. But what struck me was that it was the parents of children that I was most concerned about who never showed up. I never saw them. And so, you know, after 2 years working in inner city Baltimore, it just struck me that I needed to start earlier. You know, and what took me to this inner city daycare center was work that I had done as an undergraduate with a developmental psychologist at Johns Hopkins named Mary Ainsworth. And Mary was the leading figure in developing the empirical foundations for attachment theory, in which the basic thesis is that primates are really wired to protect their offspring. And their offspring are wired to gradually develop a sense of capacity to explore the world safely through this dance that they do with one another, that children do with their parents. And so I thought that if we could just help parents provide sensitive and responsive care to their children, irrespective of how old they were, that it would make a difference. But I have to tell you, it was the experience in inner city Baltimore just reminded me how challenging it is for parents to protect themselves and their children when the rates of crime are off the charts, when the housing stock is terrible, when there are no sources of food, fresh fruits and vegetables in their communities. All of these social and material factors are bearing down on them and making it much more challenging to care for themselves or their children. So I eventually went to graduate school to study with a person named Yuri Bronfenbrenner, who was developing this theory of human ecology, which focuses on both the material and social contextual factors that shape human development. And I have to say that I almost dropped out of graduate school, Stuart, because I was impatient, I suppose, with traditional academics and wasn't interested in just doing research for the sake of research and piling up publications. I really wanted to use whatever skills I was learning to make a difference. To make a difference, yeah.
Yeah. You know, I sometimes joke with my clients that in my closet I have a time machine to do Back to the Future therapy, you know, to change the past and make for a better foundation. But you were actually doing that. I mean, not with the same person, but you're going way back in time. I just wanted to mention just a little bit about attachment theory, and if you're familiar with Mary Ainsworth and her research, it's fabulous stuff. And that's that the theory that John Bowlby came up with is that on the savannah, if young children didn't stay in very close proximity to their parent, they would become somebody's lunch. I mean, not somebody, but some animal's lunch. And that the baby will adapt itself to the parent. And if the parent is not a receptive parent or a nurturing parent, the baby will actually learn how to suppress its own needs in order to stay close by. And that there's all kinds of insecure attachment styles. I suspect that the children that you're helping are the ones that have probably the least well-developed style, because otherwise the home would be so chaotic and disorganized and abusive without that support. And that I imagine that your program would be applicable and helpful really for a very broad swath of the population eventually. Although I think obviously you're starting with the ones that are the most at risk.
So Stuart, I actually, the evidence from our randomized trials indicates that the benefits are really concentrated in those families where the needs are the greatest. And so honestly, I feel a moral responsibility to make sure that those families who need it the most are getting this kind of service. And that the added value for families who are at lower risk is just not that discernible. I remember that the nurses who started working with us in our first trial said, "I wish I had this program when I was first becoming a parent." And, you know, as far as I knew, they were delivering an important message. But as we look at the results of our own trials, and as we look at the results of other early intervention programs, it's very clear that the added value is so much greater where the need is so much greater. And that's been a lesson that has been really driven home to us, you know, a lot in recent years.
Yeah, another thing that I was impressed by in reading your material and actually also watching a video of you speaking to a British audience, I guess fairly recently, is your emphasis on the attachment needs of the mother. Because in most of the attachment literature, it's talking about the attachment needs of the child and the attachment needs that weren't met and how that can be corrected. But obviously, the attachment instincts are on both sides.
Yes.
And you're able to harness what for most, I would think, the vast majority of parents, especially at the beginning, there is something to tap into, if you want to call it an instinct or a need to protect their young.
Absolutely. And you know, something we only, I think, knew this in a hypothetical way, we hypothesized that was what would be going on when we first began this work. And now, in the last decade or so, there has been all of this research that's been conducted showing how pregnancy, and especially first pregnancies, lead to these massive changes in women's hormonal functioning and neurocircuitry that really is designed to help parents focus on the protection of their babies. And so it's all of this work that we originally thought was that we didn't fully understand the intricacies of the neuroendocrine functioning that was shaping this protective system that was being built by mothers primarily.
And one thing that was, I think, very special about your program, I think probably there's some other programs that make use of this as well, but yours maybe was the first, which is to intervene. When I say very early, what I was getting at is, you know, during the pregnancy, I think I remember reading it was like no later than the 26th week, or at least that's how it was early on, which is really an amazing idea because it's really creating a therapeutic bond between the visiting nurse and the mother-to-be at a time when there's really a potential for that kind of attachment, and as well as a chance to protect the growing fetus.
Exactly. So, Stuart, you and I are in complete alignment about this. There are two aspects of it. One is that for mothers who have experienced trauma and disadvantage in their own upbringing, they're often naturally distrustful of others and will not reveal their needs. So nurses have to listen carefully and be respectful and caring and all of those things that are fundamental to good parenting. And I don't mean this to sound patronizing in any way. It's a matter of what, if you want, loving relationships are all about. And I think that care and love is something that nurses need to carry with them into the work that they do with families. And there have just been numerous instances where mothers will say, no one has ever cared for me the way you have. And they're referring to the nurse. You know, I've got stories of mothers who had been tortured as children and whose nurse was able to cut through it. And the mothers would say, one mother said, please, I don't want to do this to my own baby, what was done to me. So they saw it. They saw what the consequences, I suppose, of their not changing patterns of behavior that were clearly destructive. And so that relationship, building that relationship, is the heart of the program. And then and that allows them, nurses, to provide guidance to mothers who are interested. And you don't have to dig that much for mothers to say, like that young mother did who said, I don't want to do the same thing to my baby. And when you have that connection, you know, so many things become possible.
I remember reading early on, and it really stuck with me because I haven't reviewed it, but 20 years ago, whatever, I was reading the first articles about the program, that you went through different iterations of the program where you tried different professionals, a psychologist or a social worker or maybe, I don't know, a counselor, and then you came upon nurses. And I think it'd be really helpful for our audience to hear why nurses. I think that the rationale really made a lot of sense, and I can repeat it if you like, but it's better from you.
Well, you know, when we first began the program, I created a group. This is in Elmira, New York, by the way. I created a group of health professionals, pediatricians, representatives from the local health department, local department of social services, the housing agency, and so forth, who came together to help craft the nature of this program. And, you know, and I said to that group, well, how about if we had community health workers do this work? And the pediatricians said, you know something, we will work with nurses doing this, but we will underestimate in some ways the power of the program if we don't have nursing skills as part of the team. And so, you know, I went with what the pediatricians advised. I was a young guy, but some of the nurses told me I was a baby, as a matter of fact.
I see. So you didn't actually try different professionals. It was more of a thought experiment?
Well, the story, I'll tell you a little bit more about this, Stuart. We conducted one trial with nurses. We conducted our second trial with nurses. And then we got pushback from people nationally who said, you know something, these findings from these two trials, they're good. But, you know, you would get even better results if you were to hire people from the community to do this kind of work because the families trust those who share their language and their culture and their sensibilities. So we said, well, you know, that may be right. Let's give it a test. So we conducted a third trial in Denver that systematically randomized families into three groups, a group that received nurse home visitors, paraprofessional home visitors, or a control group where families received additional services on top of what would be considered usual care. The nurses and paraprofessional visitors or community health workers operated according to a very similar model. The paraprofessionals used similar guidelines, but nurses were able to elaborate more because of their clinical skills. And what we found was that nurses produced effects that were roughly twice as large as the paraprofessional visitors. And among the things that we found was that families were opening their doors more for nurses than they were paraprofessionals. And this was something that becomes kind of abundantly clear, I suppose, and that is that nurses are the most trusted profession in the U.S. and U.S. society, and there's a good reason for that. They have this caring demeanor. They have this set of skills that people recognize. I remember nurses or families hearing stories about families in our Memphis trial, primarily African-American families, saying, I've got my own nurse. And it was, how should we say this? When you're pregnant and you're expecting a baby, especially, you know, we've served so far primarily families with no previous live birth. So this is a major life transition and massive change in body, you know, functioning and structure and so forth. And women are naturally apprehensive about all these changes that are going on. And nurses bring this combination of skills, and that is caring and knowledge. That can be reassuring. And not just reassuring, but also provide concrete guidance about how to manage preparation, care for a fragile newborn, and so forth.
I guess you could say they're a natural, benign authority figure also.
Yeah.
I mean, with the emphasis on benign. I did want to ask one more question about the nurses that do the visiting. It seems to me that just as in teaching or in parenting, the linchpin is the quality of the personal qualities of the person, of the nurse. In order to scale this up, which you've been doing, that seems to me probably the most important thing of all, maybe even more important than the guidelines that you've set. And I'm aware that there are very, very particular guidelines and of documentation and feedback and setting up the systems for support and all that. But if you don't have the right person who has the right personal skills and the right attitude, the right values, the right warmth, it's not going to work very well. How do you assure that you're getting the right people, not just in one program, but in hundreds and hundreds of programs?
First of all, you've hit the nail on the head, Stuart. That is the most critical factor in determining the success of the program. It's not the only piece, but if you don't have a nurse who has these natural dispositions to serve and to be caring, it won't work. And I can tell you, one of the nurses in our original program is named Georgie McGrady. She used to remind me and the rest of the team how critical it is that nurses, first of all, be honest and forthright. And she would say to the rest of the team, you know, the mothers we serve can spot a phony a mile away, is what she would say. But the good news, Stuart, is that nursing attracts people who are oriented to serving. So there's also a huge selection factor operating and determining who goes into nursing as opposed to other professions. But of course, there's variation among nurses and their abilities to be genuine and caring and so forth. We've provided guidance to organizations about the selection process. When we began the original Elmira program, we developed open-ended scenarios that we presented to candidates for the job and asked them to reflect on the kinds of situations that were being described and listened to their reflections on these stories and used their reflections to sort out those individuals who were going to be judgmental and in their attitudes as opposed to empathic. And that approach is one that we encourage sites to employ around the country. And it's, to be honest, I'm not entirely sure how rigorously that approach has been applied, but it is one that we recommend. So it's a challenge. And the other piece I want to say, now that you raise this issue, Stuart, is that it also the work that nurses do in this program is really challenging. And it really, oftentimes nurses experience a lot of, secondary trauma themselves because of when they hear the stories about the kinds of situations that mothers are experiencing currently or have experienced, it can be traumatic. And so you need organizations that also embrace the nurses and support them and build a sense of teamwork, deep teamwork, shared support among team members to maintain a high level of functioning over time.
So that sounds like, I guess the term would be burnout. There's a potential for burnout, professional burnout.
There is, sure.
For the nurses. And I guess one way to try to prevent that is to guide the nurses in self-care skills and how to take breaks and the need for vacation and being able to compare notes with other nurses. And I think if I remember right, there was something like 8 nurses in a full program.
That's right.
And each of whom have 25 families that they're serving at any one time, which is a lot.
Yeah, it can be challenging. Yes, it is. the nurses, the teams meet weekly to engage in case conferencing and reflection. Each nurse has a weekly session with the team supervisor, and they engage in this, what's now known as reflective practice, reflective supervision, where there is a certain kind of openness, if you want, and desire to embrace the kind of emotional reactions that nurses have to the kinds of situations that they're encountering. So that we need organizations that have this kind of, the organization needs to be sensitive and supportive to the teams to maintain high levels of functioning.
And I would imagine that by necessity, all of the nurses are women. Is that true? Or,
you know something, 99% are women, and there have been men. It can be sometimes challenging because sometimes male partners can be threatened by even nurses who are being especially supportive and caring for the mothers in the program. It can be challenging for some male partners. So that difficulty gets amplified when the nurse is a male.
All right, well, let's shift now to talking about outcome measures. I imagine you must have been quite delighted when you saw how effective the program was. I mean, I imagine you thought on theoretical terms you would have imagined that it would help, but it seemed, I would think that you would have been really delighted. It would have been kind of a pivotal moment for you, I would think, when you first realized this is going to work as well as I had hoped, or close to it.
Yeah. There has been, I should say that throughout my entire career, I've been our worst critic in some ways. I mean, I feel like, yes, this has been great, but how can we make this even better? And, you know, and our first trial was conducted with this, you know, fairly low income, primarily white sample in Elmira, New York. And some people said, hey, you got a program that works. You need to make it more widely available. And I said, well, you know, it works with low-income whites in this semi-rural community, but is it going to work in inner cities with minority families, black families, where the we have histories of racism and subjugation of populations? It's we've got to test it with minorities in major urban areas. So before we could start to celebrate, we set out a new task for ourselves. And then the results of the second trial, which we conducted in Memphis, we concentrated, by the way, the Memphis trial on a much higher risk population. 85% of those enrolled in the Memphis trial were living below the federal poverty guidelines. These are folks who are literally not able to pay for food or rent this month. It is, so the levels of deprivation, yes, very different from what we see today.
Off the chart stress.
Off the chart stress, absolutely. And the results of that trial showed that we were also making a difference. And by the way, even in that trial, the benefits were more pronounced where mothers were, in a way, least equipped to manage the adversities that they were trying to cope with. And so it kind of drove home this message that we need to be reaching those who are most vulnerable. And it was at that point that I got these messages about, well, you got these results. They show they're looking pretty good, but you've got to figure out, can you do this as well with paraprofessionals, and can you serve Hispanic families? And so I was up until this point at the University of Rochester, and I got a call from the Colorado Trust, which was a philanthropy in Denver, asking me to come and talk with their board of trustees about the work we'd been doing. And so I flew out, talked to them, and when I got done with my talk, they said, we would like you to come to Denver and conduct a third trial here. And they asked me, actually, what they asked me at the end of the meeting was, what is the next study that should be done? And I said, we need to compare paraprofessional visitors with nurses and, you know, figure out whether it works with Hispanic families and so forth. And it was then they called me and said, will you come to Denver and do this? And they were able to pull together the money to do this within 3 months. And that was a lot of money in 1993 when we were invited to do that. And the results of that study showed that, again, that nurses were producing effects twice as large as paraprofessional visitors, and that the benefits were as strong with Hispanic families as they were with other groups. And it gave us just a much greater foundation for having confidence that this could really make a difference. It took us a while. It took us a couple of decades to get to the point where I would say that I felt comfortable saying this is ready for prime time.
Thanks to your perfectionism, you really paid very close attention to the quality of the research. And just for our listeners, it's incredibly unusual to do long-term longitudinal research in the social sciences because it's so difficult to do. And your studies go on for, what, 15 or more years, something like that? I mean, it really shows what happens to these kids when they grow up. And that there's very little evidence to compare with yours. I mean, this is really robust kind of evidence.
Yeah, we've been really fortunate in having wonderful collaborators who, you know, I can just tell you, we are now conducting a 30-year follow-up, Stuart, of our Memphis sample, looking at the effects of the program on maternal and child cardiovascular health and chronic disease, emergence of risks for chronic disease. And we've had a wonderful study coordinator based in Memphis who's the wife of a local minister who has devoted the last 30 years of her career to engaging and maintaining our involvement with the families in Memphis. And we owe so much to Evelyn Collins for the wonderful work she's done in that community. And honestly, Stuart, I think part of it is that I do think that we've been respectful of the families we're serving. In other words, it's not just a matter of studying families, but we've throughout treated families with respect and care. And when problems were emerging, we would step outside of the usual study protocol to make sure that those families, even irrespective of what treatment group they were in, were getting the services that they need. We took blood pressures, for example, on the part of mothers when the children were 12 and 18. And if mothers had elevated blood pressures or things that would warrant further evaluation and treatment, of course, we said we referred them for further evaluation and treatment because that's, you know, the right thing to do. And families have spontaneously said to us, we know that you've got our back. So it's that kind of mutual caring and respect that is essential for maintaining sample participant engagement over long periods of time.
And I would imagine that the nurses, in a sense, emotionally adopt their clients. I mean, there's a real strong bond that's made both ways.
Absolutely.
And that's really the real key.
Absolutely.
I want to shift now to talking about societal dimensions to this, because as we all know, American culture has a very short attention span and doesn't seem to plan very far into the future. And your program is something that shows its benefits over time. I mean, it's not an instantaneous benefit, but it's more and more dramatic the longer you look. So if you can wait until the child is in school age, you see whether they need special ed services. If you wait until they're teenagers, you see that they're not going to be as often involved in the correctional system. And then you, as you mentioned before, you can wait even longer and see how their physical health is better than without the intervention. And I don't know if this statistic is still holds, but I remember reading years ago that for every dollar spent on your program, it saves $8 in the long run. Maybe it's more now, but there's a great, great benefit, but you have to invest.
You know, one of the great affirmations for me, Stuart, is that this work has achieved bipartisan support over the decades. And I think that one of the reasons that it has achieved bipartisan support is that it has two fundamental characteristics that speak to us as human beings. First is that we get it as human beings that we need to protect mothers and young children. And that cuts across the entire political spectrum. And then added to this, and this is the piece that really reaffirms the bipartisan support for this, and that is that we've been holding ourselves accountable. We've really strived for the very best evidence that can be developed. And it's that commitment to evidence and holding ourselves accountable that I think appeals to people across the political spectrum. We've seen over the years, again, in Congress and in state houses, that leadership, policymakers, are willing to use their heads. And we're talking about going with our hearts and our minds.
And so how does the funding break down in terms of governmental funding versus nonprofit donations, for instance?
First of all, I'm not involved today in the U.S. replication of the program. We decided nearly 20 years ago that we couldn't manage U.S. replication and still try to do the academic work that we do. And so there's a nonprofit based in Denver that manages this. But so this is a wild guess, but I would say that 90 to 95% of the funding for the program comes through public sources. And there may be in small communities, local philanthropic contributions to the work. There have been rather significant philanthropic investments in the national office, the nonprofit national office that's charged with supporting further replication of the program and supporting building the technical and human infrastructure to maintain the quality of the program as it gets rolled out. I think that's the other piece that appeals to people, let's say, in the business community, and that is that there is a business model, if you want, an operating model that guides what kinds of organizations can deliver the program, what kinds of procedures need to be in place to be able to hang the nurse family partnership shingle on the by the sidewalk to say we're an NFP site. So all of that, do we have it perfect? No. We're constantly examining ourselves, and I say ourselves, I'm thinking about our national office, to make sure that it is operating as well as we want it to be. So we're constantly challenging ourselves, not satisfied with the status quo.
Right. Well, you've really set the tone, it seems to me, of the organization, and I hope it continues beyond you, that it really can become a real legacy that way. I wanted to ask you also about cultural differences. And from what you said earlier, it sounds like what you're tapping into in terms of the attachment needs and the need of parents to protect their children is universal. Is there anything in the way the program is implemented that has to be adjusted for culture, whether it's different subcultural groups here in the States, minority groups, or whatever, or overseas? Now, I know the overseas programs are mostly with English-speaking countries, I noticed, plus I think Norway and Bulgaria, I think, was the other one. Are there significant changes that need to be made, or is it just a question of that human bond?
Well, you know, that's a great question. And I have to say that when we began this work, I was, again, not entirely sure that this was going to be truly, if you want, universal. And we had been invited to deliver the program in sub-Saharan African countries. And after reviewing their capacity to really sustain the work in sub-Saharan Africa, I decided we should not do that because I wasn't convinced that we would have the ongoing human and financial infrastructure to support the development of the program. But we were invited by the Australian government to set up the program to serve Aboriginal families, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander families in Australia. And they were willing to make significant investments in doing it right and getting it sustained. And so we've made adaptations to the program. I can tell you that I visited a program site in Australia where it was blessed with a smokes ceremony by local Aboriginal women. And the artwork and the materials have all been adapted to Aboriginal culture. But the heart of the program remains the same. But both the language and the way it is delivered is the same. We've built in the program in Australia Aboriginal partnership workers. These are community health workers who partner with nurses to help ensure that there is, if you want, cultural safety on the part of the families being served. So I had one Aboriginal health leader tell me that when a white person would come on his porch, he would feel his defensive reaction go up because of the history of racism and mistreatement on the part of Aboriginals. It needs to be led by Aboriginal people. The good news is that there is significant buy-in, because I think of this does reflect something that we all as human beings do embrace. You know, we're serving Roma families, Gypsy families in Bulgaria. And of course there have been centuries of discrimination and subjugation of that population in Bulgaria. And there we're also seeing that the program is gaining significant traction. We were invited by Norway to develop the program there. And, you know, when they first invited us, I said, you look at international statistics on any health indicator, and the Norwegians are at the top of the list. And I said to them, why would you want us? And they said, we have these segments of the population that are not doing as well as we would like, and we would like this program to serve them. And so I was honored that they would want us to be of help to them. We're serving First Nations people in British Columbia and in Ontario in Canada and American Indian communities here in the U.S. So, yes, I was apprehensive about saying this is truly universal when we first started branching out and serving more diverse communities. But I've really grown to believe, Stuart, that truly we're really tapping into something that is fundamentally human.
Now, do the nurses need to be of the same ethnicity of the mothers that they're serving? And I say mothers because we haven't mentioned that the nurses also try to promote healthy relationships of the mother with other members of the family and try to involve the fathers where possible. So it's not just, we don't want it to sound like it's just helping the mother in isolation, right?
Right, exactly. Well, let me just say this. It's not essential that the nurses be of the same race or ethnicity as the families they're serving. I think it helps, but because there's a little bit of, of natural apprehension that people who have been discriminated initially. But you know something? if you're dealing with people who are caring and respectful, it comes through. It comes through. And as far as fathers go, I can tell you that from the very beginning, we have been actively engaging fathers. And one of the things that I feel really pleased about is that in our recent 18-year follow-up of our Memphis trial participants, we found that nurse-visited mothers were more likely to have been in enduring partnered relationships with men in their lives. They're more likely to have been married by the time they were the first child was 18. That we see fathers becoming more active as caregivers. But it's complicated. It's complicated because some men have been traumatized in their own upbringing. And so they are, and I suppose they don't have the, if you want, the neurologic benefits and the hormonal benefits of that come with pregnancy and caring for young children.
Exactly. They don't have a baby. You don't have a baby growing exactly. inside of them. So you don't have to, and it also removes the need to give the guidance, you know, for their own prenatal care. It's not directly them.
But you know, Stuart, you see it. It comes through so frequently, and it's so it just is so touching to see fathers feel cared for and respected. Look, there are some situations where women need to be guided to get out of really destructive relationships. Their own safety and the safety of their babies is at risk. So it can be challenging, but it's one of those reasons that I mentioned before that nurses experience this trauma, the secondary trauma in their work with families as well. But the commitment to getting it right and knowing that this is the right thing to be doing, you know, in so many ways overrides that trauma for nurses.
And the mothers, I imagine, are mostly quite young. I mean, teens or early 20s at the oldest. And I understand the intervention is with first-time mothers with the rationale that, first of all, you can help them space the timing of their second child, but also any benefits that the first child gets, presumably the mother will have gained the skills to help the subsequent child. So it makes a lot of sense.
Yes, that's right, Stuart. And that's exactly right. So one of the good things that's been happening in U.S. society in recent decades is that the rates of teen pregnancy have been plummeting. So the number of really young women bearing babies has gone down. Those who do get pregnant earlier in life are often come from really challenging experiences. So the need is very great.
I think we have time for just two more topics that I wanted to touch on. One is that I noticed that the Nurse Family Partnership Program recently merged with another program called Child First.
Yes.
And that's a big deal, I would think. And I was wondering if you could just talk just for a couple of minutes about the rationale for it and what the hopes are from this merger.
Well, what I love about this is that Child First is a program that genuinely complements what NFP does. The Child First program works with families that are really challenged, that are either involved with child welfare or on the verge of becoming involved with child welfare. And they're able to have much smaller caseloads and to work with families in a much deeper way than NFP nurses are. And they have good evidence. They have one randomized trial that shows beneficial effects on child and family functioning. They show they've got another randomized trial underway. That commitment to clinical excellence and evidentiary excellence, deep care about how the program is operationalized in communities outside of research settings. Those fundamental values are reflected in Child First. And so when I see those two programs working with local, say, Child Protective Services or child welfare agencies, where the nurse family partnership can do more of the true preventive intervention work. And when things exceed what nurses are able to do, I see this as an option for local child welfare agencies to invest in child first as a way of working deeply with families to prevent further deterioration in family functioning and to ensure that this child is going to be protected in the most thorough way. And that may mean, in some cases, of course, that children need to be removed, but in many cases, with intensive support, families can be supported to prevent removal of the child. So this is a good, it's a good combination, I think.
So if I'm understanding it correctly, so the nurse family partnership would be the preventive work starting during the pregnancy, whereas Child First is with families that have already gotten off on the wrong foot, so to speak?
I think that's right. And I think that in theory, Child First could begin in pregnancy, but I think that most of their work begins postnatally. Almost all of their work begins postnatally.
Okay, so here's the last question or topic, and that's that I'd like to talk about the implications of the work. What changes may be felt in not just in the families, but in schools, communities, maybe even whole countries? And because as a former or as a retired school psychologist, I was just thinking about the numbers. If there were a program here, and I can imagine that in every elementary school, there might be one or two fewer absolutely disruptive kids, per grade, and what that would mean for that teacher and for the grade and for the health of the school, because when kids do get off on the wrong foot and they're traumatized and acting out, it requires an inordinate amount of attention and time. I mean, I was part of meetings that would have 10 adults in it that would last for hours. I mean, and that's just a single meeting, and I would shudder to think of what's going on in the classroom. And of course, we have this idea of an inclusion program now that the kids are under almost all circumstances are supposed to stay in the regular classroom, no matter how disruptive they are. And to have one or two fewer per grade, or maybe better. I mean, we're talking about the kids that are probably the most problematic, suddenly not being so problematic. Or it's amazing.
Yeah, that's that is, I think, so right, Stuart. And I think that this idea of building children's capacity for behavioral regulation is one of those things that grows out of nurses' guidance with parents in being both more sensitive and responsive to their babies and toddlers, but also guiding them and helping them regulate their behavior as toddlers when they start to get oppositional and into things, and learning these constructive alternative ways of managing disruptive behavior is really critical. And I am willing to bet, just as you are, that the more children are provided this kind of appropriate, sensitive, regulated guidance by their parents early in life, or other caregivers early in life, those children are better regulated. And we see this. We see this based on teacher report of child behavior, that children are better regulated in early elementary school and later on in school. So what's not to like about that?
Well, I think those are wonderful words to end on. It's really been delightful to have a chance to meet you and talk with you. So thank you so much for coming on to the show.
Stuart, it's been a pleasure talking with you, and I have to say that you're having firsthand experience working in schools with children, and your obvious kind of commitment to these issues makes it a real delight to have spoken with you today.
Well, thank you. I hope that we can do it again someday.
Okay, well, thank you again for inviting me.
I'm Stuart Kelter, and you have been listening to the podcast edition of Delving In, originally broadcast on KTALLP, the community radio station in Las Cruces, New Mexico. please visit our website, lccommunityradio.org, and see what KTAL has to offer. We appreciate listener donations to help us stay on the air and to continue to grow in cyberspace.